from the Sky News Centre at 5. Air travel disruption will go into a third day at the very least as volcanic ash from Iceland continues to spread south. English airspace will remain off limits until 7 a.m. tomorrow at the earliest. But there's better news for those further north, as cloud movement means there are some flights in Scotland and in Northern Ireland. Lord Adonis says alternative arrangements are being put in place.
There's additional trains operating on the London to Scotland services. Eurostar will be operating additional trains on the London to Paris and Brussels routes, and the ferry operators are increasing their capacity too.
The husband of a postmistress found dead at their North Yorkshire village shop has been charged with her murder. 40-year-old Diana Garbutt was found dead in the living quarters of Melsonbury post office after claims there'd been an armed robbery. Robin Garbutt, who's 44, will appear at North Allerton Magistrates Court tomorrow. Teachers have backed a boycott of next month's SATs test for 11-year-olds in England. Nearly 75% of National Union of Teachers members and 61% from the National Association of Head Teachers voted in favour of the move. They argue the tests cause unnecessary stress for children. On last night's First Leaders debate on ITV, Tory leader David Cameron hinted teachers should be given more say in how youngsters are assessed.
We've got to have good external marking done properly and high standards. I think that's absolutely key. I wouldn't want to see that change, but let's set the schools free so we trust in the vocation of the teachers.
A single mother who won a race and sex discrimination case against the Ministry of Defence has been awarded just over £17,000. Tyler de Beek from South London had reportedly been trying to get £1 million. Football in England fullback Ashley Cole is in line for a shock return for Chelsea. He fractured his ankle in February and was a World Cup doubt, but he's in the Blues squad to face Tottenham tomorrow. And Lady Gaga's Bad Romance has become the most watched clip ever on YouTube. It's been viewed over 180 million times. That's the latest. I'm Kat Higgins.
Bristol Community FM. 3.2.
Hello and welcome to BCFM's Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and our guest to review this week's news in Bristol, Britain and around the world is ex-leader of the Lib Dem group on Bristol City Council and councillor now for Eastville. That's Steve Comer. Standing in for the President Deputy Leader, Simon Cook, who's coming back from the UK to the UK from Poland by coach at the moment. Our old Labour Oxford economist, Martin Summers, is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, a battle for control is raging in the tiny Channel Island of Sark, between Europe's newest democracy and the multi-millionaire telegraph owners, the Barclay twins, who've brought a little island just off Sark's coast. And if you could be bothered to tune in, how did you think yesterday's first US presidential-style TV debate in the run-up to next month's general election went? Was it all just about presenting the British public with a robotic and cynical illusion of choice? And we hear from ex-Freemasons about some of the shocking secrets of their so-called craft, and hear about a new film on the topic. Also, environmental activists from London plan to set up a Bristol eco-village tomorrow at a mystery site. Why? And what is an eco-village? That's in the second hour. On to this week's news in a minute, but first, here's our two-weekend weather forecast from metcheck.com. This weekend, sunny and 15 degrees Celsius. That's still warm, but cloudier on Sunday. So that's sunny, 15 degrees Celsius tomorrow, nice and sunny on Saturday, but a little bit cooler on Sunday. Still no rain, though. Next week, warm until the temperature plunges on Thursday till 2 to 2 degrees Celsius, and starts getting windy too. Next weekend, 24th and 25th of April, down to 3 degrees Celsius, cold that is, but feeling even colder in the wind. Showers and sleety rain, and windy. Week after next, up again temperature a bit, this time up to about 7 Celsius, but again feeling much colder in the wind. Showers and sleety rain all week except Tuesday, saying cold and windy and rainy. So the temperature really is changing when it comes to next Thursday, when we have this Prime Ministerial TV debate. Everything's getting really cold, sleety and rainy. Anyway, on to our look through the week's news now. And joining us is ex-leader of the Lib Dem group and on Bristol City Council and councillor for Eastville, Steve Comer. Steve, hello and welcome to Drive Time.
Well, thank you.
And Martin Summers is here too. Hi, Martin.
Hello.
We'll start with Steve. Steve, you were leader in opposition of the Lib Dems, but now you're only demoted to chairing the Overview and Scrutiny Management Committee. Why is that?
Well, which is actually the committee on the council that deals with all the scrutiny roles. So it is a senior role. We have contested elections for leadership of the group, and I won one and lost one. Simple as that. But that's the democratic process for you.
Okay. And you yourself from Bristol?
Yes, I am. I'm born in Bristol and moved away a few times, lived in different parts, but like the proverbial rubber ball, I seem to keep bouncing back.
Now, are you retired or do you have a day job?
No, I have a day job. I work in the civil service.
What do you do?
I work for the UK Borders Agency, dealing with international trade.
Oh, okay. Now, what paper do you read? What newspaper, daily newspaper, is your favourite?
I think probably the Independent at the moment, although I tend not to actually buy a paper every day.
You read it on the internet?
I do tend to do that a lot more, I have to say.
Okay. Now, the cabinet system, which you're part of, is that system democratic? What do you think about it?
I don't really think so. I think the problem you've got in local government in the UK is that... As with everything in our politics, Westminster and Whitehall always think they know best about everything. And they imposed on local councils a model of governance that said, well, you either have to have an elected mayor or you have to have a cabinet and scrutiny system. And this is a lot of the problem with our politics. They didn't say, well, you Bristol City Council, you decide with your residents which is the best way to run things. A central model was imposed. So what you have is a bit like the Westminster model. You have a cabinet that takes all the executive decisions and a scrutiny panel that that scrutinises them and various regulatory committees. I think it's a bit overweeningly bureaucratic. I don't think it works. The old committee system wasn't perfect, but at least it involved more councillors.
Well, it's all very well blaming central government for it, but can't Bristol fight back against having two different options, neither of which we want imposed on us?
Unfortunately, no, you can't, because the problem with dear old Britain with our own written constitution is that you don't have prescribed rights at different levels, and I think that, you know, this is a problem. It's not one that people will challenge you in the streets over, because they're more interested in whether services are getting delivered. But I think it does go to the heart of a lot of our problems, and I think we need to free it up, and we need to have much more power exercised locally. And if we do that, then people will be more engaged.
Right, you chair Overview and Scrutiny Management. That sounds very important, but actually, you would have thought that an opposition person should really be doing that.
Well, what happens is that opposition do chair a lot of the actual individual scrutiny commissions, but when you have a majority party in control, then you also have the chair of Overview and Scrutiny. It's done on a proportional basis based on the number of councillors, and it follows the precedent when we had a Labour majority. So we now have a small overall majority, so that's the way it is.
Yes, as I said before, Martin Summers is here too. He's our regular old Labour Oxford economist and pundit. Now, Martin, here's one for you this week. When it comes to a showdown between the City of London and the Treasury, who holds more cards?
Well, I mean, this brings up the question of what is called in the textbooks regulatory capture. The Treasury, in theory, is a public interest body designed to pursue the public interest. The City of London, of course, is a private interest. But what tends to happen is there's a revolving door. The kind of people who end up in the Treasury are people who've worked in the City and vice versa. And so eventually, by a process of osmosis, what the Treasury wants to do tends to be pretty much what the City of London wants most of the time.
So where does the public get a look in here at all?
Well, it's a very good question, isn't it? A lot of our politics at the moment is being driven by the financial interest at the heart of British life. And is anybody capable of disciplining them or telling them what to do? It doesn't seem so.
What about the confrontation between Labour Prime Minister Harold Wilson and the City in the 1970s?
Well, in those days, Labour governments were more robust. I mean, they used to call these kinds of political shenanigans a banker's ramp. So the bankers would always be saying, we can't afford this, we can't afford that, you'll have to do so and so. And of course, that's not always true. I mean, when we came off the gold standard in the 30s, all the Labour cabinet had been told that we couldn't come off the gold standard, it was quite impossible. But then, of course, when we did come off the gold standard, I can't remember the name of the cabinet minister, they never told us we could do that. And this is what tends to happen, is that the politicians who are supposedly overviewing that what's going on are often lacking in necessary expertise. They're, you know, it's very difficult for them to understand what's happening. And by and large, there's a lot of deference. There's a presumption that they know what they're doing, and it's not for the likes of us to stick our finger in. And that goes right to the top.
But Harold Wilson called the city's bluff, didn't he? He said, look, if you think this is such an important issue, I will call a general election.
Yeah, I mean, he also, that was when he mentioned the gnomes
and
of
then
Zurich.
They banked
gnomes
off.
Of Zurich.
They backed off, didn't they?
Well, that's right. It, real politics is like that. You know, you stake out your position and then you stare each other out and see who blinks first.
But we're now
we need a bit more of that.
Well, we're now talking about potentially, anyway, taking away this power of prime ministers to call general elections, to have a fixed term. What are both of your views on that? Because that, to me, seems like a major constitutional change. If the prime minister, say, for example, there's some sort of crisis or a political crisis, that really should be, the prime minister surely should be able to say, right, now we do have to have a general election. What are your thoughts on that first, Steve?
I disagree with that. I think we should have fixed term elections. We have fixed term elections for local authorities, for the European Parliament, for the Scottish and Welsh Parliaments, and I think we should for the National Parliament as well. There is always going to be, you know, an emergency provision that if you have a two-thirds majority or something for a dissolution, then it can happen. But I think the power should be removed from a prime minister.
Of course, there was all that talk when Gordon Brown first came to power that he might call a snap general election on a sort of honeymoon period of being a new broom.
And of course, wishes he had.
I think he may do. Martin, what are your thoughts about this idea anyway?
Well, I think things like fixed-term parliaments are one aspect of what we need to do, which is to overhaul our constitution. I mean, Steve was mentioning earlier the great British non-constitution, and I don't think we can carry on bodging along as we have been over the last generations. We really do have to reform the lot. And I'm personally very disappointed in the wash-up at the very, you know what the wash-up is, at the very end they're allowed to push one bill through before the dissolution. And instead of pushing through the electoral reform proposal, which would have been the most politically sensible thing to do in my view, they pushed through this digital nonsense from Mr. Mandelson. I mean, I despair sometimes with the Labour Party leadership. It's the striker's fear of the open goal. I mean, what they should have done is told the people, especially Lib Dem voters in marginal constituencies, look, if you vote for us one more time, we can change the electoral system, and then we can start moving ahead in a different way. And the Labour Party is creeping crabwise towards this obvious conclusion, but they should show more enthusiasm for it, in my view.
I see you nodding there, Steve.
Yeah, I mean, and they had it in their manifesto in 97, and they could and should have done it.
Yeah.
The problem with the British system is because it exaggerates the winner's margin. When you're winning, you think you're always going to be winning, and you forget that, you know, however good you are, actually, there comes a point where people just get bored with you. And even for that reason, you can lose in the end. And I think this was a major flaw of the early part of the Blair-Brown government, was that they didn't move on constitutional reform when they had the opportunity to do it. They did the Scottish and Welsh parliaments, but they didn't move on electoral reform. Even if they just moved a little way, and I think what Gordon Brown is now proposing is a little move, even if they brought proportional representation in for local government, which they've done very successfully in Scotland, that would have been something, but they didn't move on that. And I think, as Martin says, the digital economy bill shows the control freakery at the heart of government, where you have this ill thought out legislation that's been pushed for by certain siren voices within the industry, but I think will be to our long-term detriment.
Right, well, let's go on to have a look at the week's news now. And the first story we're looking at is the Polish plane crash, which happened just after last week's programme. And we hear today, after a little bit of investigation has been done, apparently the Russian Supremo, Vladimir Putin, has taken personal control of this investigation. We hear that the Russian investigators say that the black box retrieved from Saturday's devastating plane crash did not provide any evidence the pilots had been pressurised to land, because that was one of the first things we heard, was that there may have been some pressure on the pilot to land. Officials said the transcripts of conversations from inside the cockpit rebutted widespread theories the Polish delegation had insisted the pilot land despite heavy fog at Smolensk Airport. And of course, he did make several attempts to land before finally failing and crashing. What are your thoughts about this, Martin? Do you want to go first on this, on the significance of this plane crash?
Well, it's obviously highly significant, because I mean, it's extraordinary to me that they've put all of their top officials, military, business, political elites, all on one plane. I mean, that's the obvious point to make. I mean, if that, if you do that, it's like Manchester United's 1950 air crash, isn't it? You know, you're going to lose everybody in one go. And of course, there's potential here for tension between Russia and Poland. Kaczynski is very anti-Russian politician, and so there's real potential for you know, and Poland is also going to sight some of these missiles, in US missiles in their country, which is actually annoying the Russians enormously. But I think that from what I've been seeing, the Polish establishment are very much not blaming Russia for what's happened, and the Russians seem to be pulling out all the stops to get to the bottom of what has happened. Let's hope it really is just a tragic accident, and it'll bring everybody together and we can all move forward in a constructive fashion. But I think the Poles need to think very hard about whether they should be sticking US missiles on their soil in the face of the Russians. I don't think that's very wise at all.
Yeah, I don't think any escalation of missiles is wise. I mean, firstly, it's a major tragedy for the Polish people and the Polish nation. And I think we should remember that, and particularly poignant given the commemoration that it was going to Smolensk for.
That's right. It was the 70th anniversary of the Katyn massacre. I mean, Martin, do you want to just tell us about what
the Katyn massacre was? It was carried out in 1939, and basically the whole Polish officers corps was executed and thrown in pits.
And by the Russians.
It was claimed by the Russians that this had been done by the Germans, mm. but I mean, it's pretty clear that it wasn't the Germans. The Russians have in fact admitted that they did it, but they won't actually release the documents and so on from the time, because there's still tension between them and the Poles.
And I think it's good that there is this recognition by the Russians that their previous generations were responsible for this, and this was part of the sort of rapprochement between the two or an attempt to do it.
So do you think that rapprochement...
On the substantive issue you raised at the beginning about the evidence and so on, frankly, a reassurance from a former KGB person that it's all right doesn't actually inspire me with a lot of confidence. No. I'd actually want to... I don't speak Russian, but there are lots of people here who do, and I'd actually want the tapes released before
I notice in today's Guardian that the Russians have made copies of all of the black box recorders and have now handed them over to the Polish government so that they can double-check everything.
The Russians will be worried that somebody on the Western side is trying to stir trouble between them and the Poles. So that's why they'll be keen to get to the bottom of it in a way that will reassure the Poles.
But how will this affect this rapprochement, at least what was going to happen at this anniversary?
Well, actually, the anniversary itself was problematic, because the Russians didn't actually want them to come. Yeah, they'd invited themselves to have this celebration, and they weren't doing it with the Russians. The Russians basically were very cool about the whole idea. So obviously there is a potential for somebody if there was more to this than meets the eye, then this is potentially causing problems between these two countries. I used to live in Poland, so I lived there for 3 years, so I know quite a lot about how the politics there work. And Kaczynski is actually quite a divisive figure even inside Poland, and he was unlikely to win the next election. But of course now he's dead. The whole Polish politics has come together. The nation is united in its grief, because of course they've not just lost politicians there, they've lost all their military leadership, they've lost quite a lot of senior people. And Leszek Miller, who I used to know, who was the former Social Democrats minister, was saying that it's going to be very hard to replace these people. Sometimes you say people are irreplaceable, and he's saying, some of these people really are irreplaceable from our point of view.
I mean, I think this is why it's so tragic for Poland, because this is exactly what they went through with Katyn, of course, and it made the rebuilding after the war more difficult, and it made it much more easy for the Russians to actually take over and have a satellite state there. And it's almost different circumstances, but it's echoes of history coming back.
When I lived in Poland, I lived in eastern Poland near Lublin, and whenever they did any kind of building work of any kind, they would find bodies, mass graves, and they were either Russian or German. I mean, where I lived in Lubartov, the mass graves had all been done by the Germans, because it was a Jewish town, and they'd arrived in 1939, lined up the whole Jewish population, executed them, and buried them in the central park. So we used to sit in the park having a picnic, but everybody knew that underneath the ground there were literally thousands of Jewish bodies. And that's the same. I mean, Poland has had a very, very tragic history. And let's hope that something better is going to come out of this latest tragedy.
Okay, on to the next story. And is this the historic, supposedly anyway, leaders' debate? A shock victory for Nick Clegg, says the Daily Mail today, as instant polls say he won the historic TV showdown. Now, did you two watch the historic TV showdown last night? In Manchester, I think it was filmed for ITV?
Yes.
Yes.
And what is your verdict? Do you want to go first, Steve?
Yes, I think it was good to see. I'm worried about this overemphasis on leaders that we have in our political culture at the moment. I used to say when I was a leader, don't you know, the old Bob Dylan quote of don't follow leaders and watch parking meters, I always thought was a good adage to have. And I do worry about this presidentialization of our politics, I suppose I could call it. And I think but I think it's useful that you do have the three figureheads debating it. We had a rather surreal experience in the last election where a Question Time audience saw them individually one at a time, and I think that was a bit ludicrous. So I think it was good to move that way. I think it actually got a lot of the issues out into the open, and I think that's probably better than what you'd have before, which is a series of set piece interviews and photo opportunities. So I think it has actually given some depth, and we'll see how they go in the future.
Yeah, well, I'd like to second this about presidentialism. I mean, we have a situation, really, where we're choosing a king for the next 5 years. The British Prime Minister has become all-powerful under Margaret Thatcher and under Tony Blair in particular. Even the smallest details of everything that was organised in the country is basically decided by the Prime Minister's office. It's not by the Cabinet anymore. And I think we've got to get away from this idea that we just, you know, have some wise king who decides everything, and get to, you know, let's get some committees and with a balance of skills on to run things. You know, committees are often, committees are slow, but, you know, if you've got a variety of people involved, you can often get a better result than just having one bulldozer in charge.
Some of the rules which have to be adhered to by all these prime ministerial candidates, although I'm not sure if Nick Clegg really is a prime ministerial candidate, is he, Martin? Would you say he is, since he's your man?
Well yes, because anyone who with a party fielding enough candidates to form a government is a prime ministerial candidate, and you know, polls go up and down.
I think that's absolutely reasonable. I mean, you know, the Liberal Democrats are showing quite well in the opinion polls now. You know, they used to be the second party before the Labour Party supplanted them in the latter part of the 20th century. I think that it's a bit unfair on Plaid Cymru and the SNP, although that I understand they're going to get their separate discussions. I mean, if we change the electoral system, we won't be bothered with this presidentialism so much. We can move to a different, you know, how they do it in the rest of Northern Europe is much less hysterical than our approach.
Britain is on course to have a population of 70 million by the year 2029, apparently, because of soaring net immigration. The main parties have largely avoided highlighting the issue. Do you think that, this is again a little quote from the Daily Mail today, do you think that really in this style of debate you really do get to the bottom of these topics, or does it need a little bit more, maybe a moderator to be more interventionist? I just found that the chap that was moderating the discussion, all we kind of heard from him was, Mr. Cameron, and it was kind of almost barking out the next person, the name of the next person who was ordered to speak, rather than some kind of, you know, cross-examination.
Yeah, it's quite funny, as Alistair Stewart. I remember Alistair Stewart from my days in the National Union of Students, where he was probably one of the only student union leaders to wear a suit in the early 1970s. I felt you do sometimes need, with topics like that, to get people with more specialist knowledge in to actually challenge, I think. But it is a difficult area, and it's a complex area, and it doesn't lend itself easily to the sort of soundbite politics we seem to be having now.
So you're looking forward to Bristol's one next Thursday?
Yes, very much so. Looking forward to all three. I think it's quite good that they're themed. I think it's Foreign Affairs next week and the economy in week three, and I think it's good. It's captured a bigger TV audience than I expected, 10 million more than Coronation Street that preceded it, I understand, which is staggering. I whether it stays at that level, it may not.
I wonder how many of those 10 million made it to the end.
Well, I don't know. I'm sure the researchers can actually tell you.
I was flagging after about 40 minutes. I can tell you, I was just thinking, I don't know if I can bear any more of this. Anyway, Martin.
I think one of the 10 million people watched last night, and it does have a kind of cup finalish feel about it, doesn't it? Yeah. And this election is also, you know, an open election. I would like to see coming out of this election a complete reform of our politics, and I think we may be able to get that. But under the current electoral system, it's almost like a kind of lottery. It shouldn't be a lottery. We should be able to decide on our direction of travel and go there. Let's hope this is the kind of birth pangs of a new kind of way of doing things.
Well, the rumours are that the next week's debate is at the Arnold Feeney next Thursday. Ah. So apparently we're not supposed to know until 10 p.m. on Wednesday evening where it's officially going to be. But that's the rumour.
The Arnold Feeney.
It's quite funny that a few weeks ago we were told it was going to be in Bristol, and they then backtracked on that and said it's going to be somewhere in the southwest, I think we've all known here for some time that it's going to be in the city.
I just want to stress that is only a rumour until the official announcement of Wednesday 10 p.m.
Well, we love rumours.
Anyway, another big story today: the Office of Fair Trading is levying its biggest fine ever, which is a total of £225 million fine for cigarette price fixing. Now, Bristol's a big cigarette city, and what about this? All these companies sitting down and. Let's just have a look at some of these figures. It's also supermarkets that have been involved in this price fixing, as well as the manufacturers. So it just sounds to me like they're all sitting around a table, these cigarette manufacturers and the big supermarkets, and carving themselves out a little racket. And in the OFT, there is going to be some legal challenges to this, so let's see how that goes. But it's interesting that Tesco's and Sainsbury's didn't get involved in the big supermarkets weren't involved, apparently. And of course, so you've got the two big supermarkets who aren't being fined, but the smaller supermarkets, which are. I do find that a bit strange that only the small supermarkets are part of this racket. Steve, anyway.
Well, I think Sainsbury's didn't get fined because they blew the whistle or something. That was the story I heard.
Nothing to do with Lord Sainsbury being in the Labour government.
I'm sure absolutely nothing to do with that at all. Big Tobacco is fiddling the system. Well, you know, there's a surprise. I think the influence of the tobacco industry and the way it operates is highly dubious in a number of areas, and I think it's an area that could be looked at in taxation. I mean, I need to be a little bit careful what I say, but because of who my employer is. But, you know, there is a large volume of tobacco that leaves this country and comes back again. In container lorries and so on from elsewhere.
So how does that happen? What's the point of that? Why would a company, you know, send this tobacco out of the country and bring it back?
Because if you describe the lorry as something else and it doesn't get found by my colleagues, then taxation is avoided. But you have to say, is this all, as we're led to believe, independent middlemen, or is Big Tobacco complicit? And we now have this. Aspect as well that's coming out, and I think it's a fairly small cartel of tobacco companies, and I think in a number of ways they're very skillfully manipulating the market for their product.
Well, the only real mystery in the list of fines for Imperial Tobacco, Gallagher, the Co-op, supermarkets, Asda, Safeway doesn't exist anymore, does it? No, I don't think it does. Morrison's, Summerfield, TM Retail, First Quench, and TNS Stores, which is One Stop Stores. The only one I can't quite understand here is the £3,300,000 fine for Shell. I mean, maybe that's just their
garages, probably.
Yeah, petrol station retail outlets. Anyway, nice to see that something's being done to actually protect the poor old consumer, because it looks like
is the poor old consumer with tobacco, isn't it? I mean, they're forcing up the price of tobacco, and perhaps we ought to have a higher price for tobacco anyway, but not the money in their pockets.
What they've done is they've taken this money off of the consumer, haven't they? So this is why they're being fined by the OFT. The next story we're going to look at is a teenage white supremacist who planned to overthrow the government. Now, we're very used to hearing on the big main headlines about so-called Islamists and Islamist alleged terror, but this is a white supremacist who planned to overthrow the British government. A teenage white supremacist whose name was Nikki Davison was behind a neo-Nazi group which wanted to overthrow the government, a court heard. He's 19 years old and a former milkman's assistant. He's accused of being one of the founders founders of the Aryan Strike Force, an online far-right group set up by his father Ian. The aim of the group, apparently, was to carry out ops and topple the government, Newcastle Crown Court heard. Now, what are your thoughts about this case, Martin? Do you want to start on this one?
Well, this is the first I've heard of this. I mean, as you say, when we're used to hearing about this as a rather sad individuals of Islamist persuasion, like the lad that ruined his life in Bristol, that we know of, whose name I've now forgotten.
Andrew Ibrahim.
He used to come to Stop the War meetings and sit at the back and say not very much.
Oh, right.
And when he was arrested, the police came to us and said we had these maps in his possession of central London. And we said, yes, those are the maps we use for people to get back to coaches when they go on demonstrations. But, I mean, it's sad when people that age are being dragged into political extremism, which is ruining their lives. And, you know, obviously, you know, the police have got to act if there's a serious threat.
The trouble is, of course, that all you need is a couple of clicks on the internet to download some of these dubious-sounding files, like the Anarchist Cookbook, and there are some other ones about how to make various types of toxins, like including ricin. All it takes is a couple of clicks, and that's it. You're then a potential terrorist.
Yeah, I mean, you can't, and it's very difficult to stop that, and you couldn't stop it even when people were running off carbon copies or whatever. But
I mean, I can remember borrowing books from the library, which have got diagrams of how to, how to make a nuclear bomb, an H bomb. But you know, these are things published in the 1950s, and you'd look at these and think this is curious and interesting. But I wasn't a terrorist; I was just reading an encyclopedia.
It's definitely scary stuff. I mean, I read this and I had echoes of I think it was Copeland, the bomber in London, a few years ago. And yes, whether it's religious extremists or whether it's political extremists, it's certainly worrying when people feel that their only solution is to start producing ricin and poisoning people.
Yeah, can I just also point out, though, we shouldn't get overexcited here. I mean, the kind of individuals like this and like the Andrew Ibrahim who are sitting in their bedrooms, loners, downloading things off the internet, they are not serious terrorists. Serious terrorists are people like the Irish Republican Army, who are organised, who've got an agenda, who really know how to blow things up. That was a real threat. This, in fact, is not a real threat in the same kind of way. And I'm not saying we should be complacent, but we shouldn't get carried away. We're talking about a 19-year-old boy here.
Well, it's just gone 5:30 now, and time to take a break from the news review to hear our guest Steve Comer's choice of music. Steve, what's the song, and why did you choose it?
It's from Jake Thackeray, and it's the Castleford Ladies Magic Circle. I haven't heard this for a while, so when I looked at the CDs coming in, I thought, yes, that'd be worth another spin, and it's something to lighten the mood a bit, I think.
The Castleford Ladies Magical Circle meets tonight in an upstairs aspidistra room that's lit by candlelight, where Elizabeth Jones and Lily O'Grady and three or four more married ladies practice every week unspeakable pagan rites. Dressed in their Sunday coats and their flowerpot hats, respectable middle-aged ladies running to fat at that. There's Elizabeth Jones and Lily O'Grady and three or four more married ladies, each with a Woolworth's broomstick and a tubby cat. But they don't waste time with a Ouija board or a seance now and again. No, none of your wittering, twittering, petty poltergeists for them. No, Elizabeth Jones and Lily O'Grady and three or four more married ladies prefer to be tickled by the whiskery chins of bogeymen. Their husbands potter at snooker down the club, unaware of the devilish jiggery poke and rub-a-dub-dub, while Elizabeth Jones and Lily O'Grady and three or four more married ladies are frantically dancing naked for Beelzebub. And after the witch's picnic and the devil's grog, after their savage pantings, their hysterical leapfrog, well, Elizabeth Jones and Lily O'Grady and three or four more married ladies go back home for cocoa and the epilogue.
be careful how you go of a Saturday night. If you see a little old lady passing by, it very well might be Elizabeth Jones or Lily O'Grady, or one of those satanical ladies. Their eyes are wild and bright, their cheekbones all alight. Don't go where they invite, because the Castleford Ladies' Magical Circle meets tonight.
I'm not quite sure when that's from, probably the late 1960s or early 1970s. That's Jake Thackeray and the Castleford Ladies' Magic Circle from an LP, well, actually a CD with a few extra tracks called La-Di-Da. The choice of our guest today, who's a Lib Dem councillor for Eastville, Steve Comer. Yes, as I say, Jake Thackeray there. Now, on to our next story, Steve. This is a UK big firms. This is in today's, last weekend's Sunday's. It's independent on Sunday. UK's big firms are warning of a danger in a new corporate code. Opponents of the annual re-election of directors fear a move is a charter for mischief-making by activist shareholders. British Airways and several other top UK companies have warned that the revised corporate governance code to be published next week could lead to disgruntled employees removing all their directors. The new code plans to introduce annual re-election of directors, but British Airways, currently hit by cabin crew strikes, called by the union Unite, warned that staff owning shares could use them to leave the company leaderless. Steve, what's your thoughts about this one?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? They're all running scared of a bit more democracy. I mean, I thought one of the things that surprises me, actually, as a public sector trade unionist, is that I'm surprised private sector trade unionists don't actually make more use of things like company AGMs and, you know, buy a few shares and take up your option to attend. Whether you'd win many votes is another thing, but certainly there's a publicity angle which could be done, and I know environmental groups and so on have done that quite successfully with a number of firms and tried to force issues like fair trade through. I find this a bit strange. I mean, the only company I've got shares in is Bristol Rovers Football Club, and you know I usually go to the annual shareholders meeting, but the majority of shares are owned by directors anyway, so you know that yes, it's an exercise in having your say in terms of changing anything, then probably not going to happen. So I don't see what this this great threat is that Willie Walsh and his colleagues are so afraid of. You know, at the end of the day, it'll be shareholders that elect the directors of a company, and I don't see that changing it from thirds to an annual election actually changes things dramatically at all.
Well, that's right. I mean, it doesn't seem they seem to be protesting about something that's no real threat to them at all. Perhaps we ought to consider about the structure of our companies. German companies are by law have to have a, if they're above a certain size, have to have a works council, which all the workers elect people to that works council, and they pursue a policy which they call co-determination, and there are certain things like closing of factories, moving of jobs, changing of job descriptions which have to be cleared by the works council. The works council doesn't try and run the company, that's left in the hands of the managers. But of course in Germany, of course, like Volkswagen, many of the workers will own shares as well, but they've also got a veto over certain kinds of decisions through the company structure. And you could say, well, that's just bureaucratic and red tape and all the rest of it, but in actual fact, of course, in the long run, the alignment of the interests of the managers and the workers through this co-determination strategy is actually much, much more constructive than our trench warfare. And, you know, perhaps we ought to reconsider the whole of company law to make companies responsible to all of their stakeholders, not just to the shareholders.
Well, one does wonder why it is that these sort of regulations are only coming in now, right at the very, very end of a Labour government. It seems like, I mean, there's still consultations going on whether this is actually going to be imposed or not. Wouldn't it be much easier to have for Labour to have actually got this sorted out earlier on in their term rather than leaving it till now?
Well, yeah, they had to want to do it to do that, didn't they?
Yeah, that's right. And of course, and this will not go ahead if the Conservatives win the election. It'll die the death.
Okay, on to the next story. Reprieve, which is a human rights charity, stands up to government bullies. Reprieve has attacked the government for trying to bully the charity into dropping legal action in the case of two men kidnapped by British forces in Iraq 6 years ago. Despite continued pressure from the charity, the British government's refused to confirm the identity of two foreign nationals seized by British troops in Iraq, and to confirm rendered to the US forces in Afghanistan, which basically just means arrested and handed over. Following laborious investigations on three continents, Reprieve believes it's been able to identify the two men as Yunus Rahmutallah and Amuntallah Ali. The government has previously admitted to rendering two men to the notorious Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan, but has refused to name them. This is a kind of legal black hole, Steve, isn't it?
So, yeah, it's a whole murky business of rendition and the Iraq war and so on. I mean, I think, sadly, it's probably going to be years before the whole truth of this this madcap adventure actually comes out.
So Reprieve have managed to identify these people. Yeah, why on earth are the government legal officers now trying to stop them identify, or at least stop the government actually doing anything about it?
Yeah, unbelievable that, you know, as I say, I mean, it's a credit to Reprieve that they've actually managed to get the names, but, you know, it throws a light on the whole murky, unsavoury business.
Yeah, I mean, our listeners, I think we've mentioned this before, they can always do a search on their computers and look up Ben Griffin, who was an SAS trooper who left the SAS a few years ago, saying, look, we are involved all the time in handing people over to the Americans and to others for torture, and we know what's happening because we are used to do... we're not allowed to actually arrest them, yeah? Because if we arrested them, there'd be some kind of legal comeback.
So what do they do? So just grab their arms?
They grab hold of them, and then they hand them over to the Americans, and they don't go through any process, and they know that they're being taken away to be tortured. Bagram Air Base, people have died under torture in Bagram Air Base. That's already proven. Now, I think Ben Griffin is to be greatly commended for his stand that he's taken. And he's under a gagging order, but he's the stuff that's up on the internet, he's said, you know, we know what's going on, and we're not happy about it. And I think he's a credit to the British Army, that boy.
And now, apparently, the Lee Day & Co. solicitor Jamie Beegent, who filed papers with the High Court yesterday on behalf of Reprieve, says, we have been compelled to issue legal proceedings because, despite repeated requests, the Secretary of State has refused to disclose even the identities of these two men. And then he carries on, it frankly beggars belief that the Secretary of State has sought to rely upon the Data Protection Act to support his refusal. Is this really a data protection issue? Sounds, well, to me, much more like some sort of quite serious criminal, potentially criminal imprisonment or kidnap or something, not a data protection issue.
No. I mean, clearly this is, some lawyer has found a convenient bit of legislation to hang this one on.
The government seems to like this Data Protection Act, and the Human Rights Act is also being used sometimes, as well as health and safety, when you would think, actually, some rather more weighty criminal legislation should be used.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, that's right. I mean, we've got to get back to a rule of law. Everybody's got to obey the law, whoever they are, and that includes the government, and especially the government, because if the government doesn't obey the law, well, why the hell should anybody else? And, you're making the terrorist case for them, aren't you?
And the problem with Iraq, you know, you start off with a war that's illegal in the first place.
Absolutely.
And you then now have illegality, you know, piled upon illegality. And, it's hardly surprising that, people get highly cynical about what we're being told.
Well, we're paying our taxes for these government lawyers, aren't we, to do these data protection requests to try and keep people who are in prison out of the public eye, really. This is what it's about, isn't it?
Yes.
And, of course, their families then don't even know if they are the people in there. You know, so you've got a horrible knock-on effect throughout the whole entire family. I can't see how this sort of thing can carry on, really.
Well, it is carrying on, but it ought to stop.
Yeah.
We've got to get back to rule of law. I mean, we had our Good Friday Agreement discussion a couple of weekends ago. And, of course, what's really important to underpin that is that there's got to be a police service which everybody in the community can support, whatever their political views, and it's got to be above politics. And this is not what's going on here.
Yeah, but what can we do about these Foreign Office lawyers who are doing everything they can to use our money to stop charities like Reprieve getting the information about these hidden prisoners for the families?
I think it has to be getting the exposure, getting it in the public domain. And I think that, you know, that's what will change it, as the court of public opinion.
Okay, on our next story, which is actually a couple of weeks old, this is the Russian ex-spy, which has bought Britain's independent newspapers. And I thought it'd be nice to wait until we had a Lib Dem in, because most of the Lib Dems seem to say that they prefer the independent, as you did earlier on, Steve. This is about the £1 purchase of the independent newspaper and the independent on Sunday by a Russian oligarch. So, Martin, can you tell us a little bit about Lebedev, and who is this guy that's now running the Independent newspaper?
Well, I don't know a great deal about him as an individual, but I do know a bit about the Russian oligarchy. They were people who were well-placed during the fall of communism and the dirty privatisation which followed to snap up assets at far less than what they were really worth, and you know, to consolidate a kind of a rule, as it were, over the society.
Well, he already owns the Evening Standard, which he's converted into a free sheet, and also has interests in banking and aviation, and co-owns with ex-Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev a 49% holding in the Novaya Gazeta newspaper, which has been critical of the Kremlin in Russia.
Yeah, I mean, this whole link between wealthy individuals with business interests owning newspapers, we're going to be talking about that in the second hour, as you mentioned at the beginning of the programme. And if you look around the world, there's a very disturbing trend for media moguls to be the political makers and breakers, and the obvious person to mention in this context is Signor Berlusconi. But you've got a similar character, Maldonado, in Brazil. Berezovsky, who's in exile now in Britain, he was a similar kind of media mogul in Russia. And of course, if you control media, you can then control public opinion, which means you can then control the legal process, which allows you to carry on doing the things you want to do, privatisations, property deals, and so on. And we've got to get a grip on these oligarchs, because it's not just in Russia that we've got a problem with them.
So, Steve, are you a little bit disappointed to see your paper taken over by a Russian oligarch, or do you think everything's going to be fine?
Well, I think it was run by an Irish oligarch before. I mean, who knows? It seems to have done quite a good job with the Evening Standard. I do travel to London quite regularly, and that seems to be fine. But, I mean, I partly agree with Martin. I think the idea that these things can sort of be bought and sold by people with large amounts of money, I think there is something a bit distasteful about that, because I think you haven't got the alternatives there. And even The Guardian, you know, owned by the Scott Trust, I mean, that's had its problems, and that's disposed of a lot of its I'm not sure where that's going to go in the long term, because it's disposed of a lot of its evening papers, which historically were what propped it up from a financial point of view. So I mean, I think it is a real problem. I mean, when we talk of media moguls, the one spectre that always looms, of course, is Rupert Murdoch, because he's a global one, you know, there are others as well, and I think it is a problem. You've seen what's happened with Italy and the way Berlusconi has come up through that route, and it is a problem, and regulation is fine, but it only takes you so far.
Yeah, I mean, this what will happen if we're not careful? I mean, you know, Rupert Murdoch has now put a paywall around his, or is putting up a paywall around his...
Well, he wants to put up a paywall. Yeah, he's threatening
to. It's not clear whether that's going to work, but you know, Tony, the problem that journalists have today is that nobody wants to pay for content. But in that situation, millionaires and billionaires can afford to run papers and television stations at a loss, because where they make their real money is once they've bent public opinion where they want it to go, they can then do the property deals and get the contracts from the government, which is what they're really interested in. So they use the media as a means of moulding the mind of the population towards their non-media interests. And of course, nobody can compete with that. If they're actually able to run these things at a loss, then they're going to drive out like the stuff like The Guardian. And, you know, we really need to get a grip on giving people a proper spectrum of opinions to listen to. I mean, that's what I felt about the debate the other night, is that we're only hearing one spectrum of opinions there. I mean, you know, people need to be exposed to a wider spectrum of opinions so that we don't all just end up spouting the same stuff.
Well, one of the things we're going to be doing in the second hour tonight is having a listen to George Galloway on Sky News, and you could see that there's a complete different point of view. One of the things he does is he points out, as you'll hear if you're listening the next hour or so, that they have a particular agenda on Sky News, and even the questions that they're asking him are framed around a particular view of history. Mm-hmm. And he points out, as very few of the leaders of the main parties will ever do, that actually the whole attitude and where the media are coming from on a particular topic is really completely wrong. Anyway,
I mean, Martin makes a valid point about content, which I'd like to pick up briefly. I mean, I've been home a bit more than I have been recently, and I've watched a lot more news, and I do find it quite quite illuminating to look at something like Euronews or look at even something like Press TV from Iran or the various, you know, Russia Today and so on. And you do see a completely different perspective. And I think our media here is very Brito-centric. And, you know, we don't get, well, Anglo-American centric, actually, because, you know, we will always get more stories on British media about what's happening in America than we will about what's happening in France or Belgium across the channel, which always seems a bit strange to me.
Martin is always going banging on, I might even say, about is it Robert Gates, this American Defence Secretary?
Robert Gates.
And we never hear this really on the mainstream media in this country at all.
Robert Gates is the current US Defence Secretary. He was in charge of the CIA's operation in Afghanistan in the 1980s. And if you say, well, who set up Al Qaeda? It was Mr. Gates. It's the same fella. And he's the guy who just came to Europe recently and said, we've got too pacifist. This is because the Dutch are withdrawing from Afghanistan, saying that we've got too pacifist and we need to pull our socks up and get a bit more militaristic like them. And I just begin to think, I actually feel that somebody like Mr. Gates perhaps ought to be interrogated. He was an Iran-Contra criminal, and he was given a pardon by George Bush. They have this rather bizarre system where an outgoing president can pardon any 200 people, whatever crime they've committed, he can pardon them, and he pardoned them, but they should have been prosecuted.
But this is always happening, you know, my enemy's enemy is my friend. I mean, you know, the British did this all over the world when we had an empire divided and rule.
Do you think we're still in the same
communal context?
Are we still in the same habit then of just literally copying what our leaders are saying, or at least some of our mainstream media seems to be, it has to follow the line of the establishment and the military, really?
Yeah, I mean, I've been staggered with the election coverage that we've had over the last couple of weeks and how Westminster-centric a lot of the media that cover politics are. And, you know, they completely miss the fact that there's a whole range of things that are happening in communities up and down the country. And it's all about this tiny Westminster village inhabited by this rather closeted class of people who live in this bubble by the Thames. And, you know, I think it's very unhealthy, and I'd hoped with devolution we would break that up, but it seems that we haven't.
Now, you've mentioned Press TV and Russia Today, which are two satellite channels. Are there any other channels you'd recommend? Euronews, you said?
Euronews, I think, is very good because it's a digest of news, and it's from around the EU, so it's our immediate neighbours. But so I tend to like Euronews because it you know, you can watch it for half an hour, and it tends to repeat it through the day. But
now, I saw this a few years ago, and they had this thing called No Comment, which was literally just footage shot without any kind of journalistic input, spin or anything like that, and that's, I think, something which is really missing.
And I think that's right. And if you look at the No Comment plot, particularly when they show something like Darfur natural disasters and so on, and it really does bring it home to you, and I think that's actually quite good. And sometimes we do strange things, don't we? I mean, if you have football on the TV, you have to have somebody talking all the way through it. I find with a lot of coverage, if you've got, you know, like with the TV debate, you had to have people sat outside Granada Studios with Granada in the background. And we do a lot of these things that are, you know, it could just as well be a picture or a photograph in the background. So there are a lot of these things that are done in our news presentation that are really now starting to get a bit past their date, I think.
Yeah, I think what I tend to cull my information from the internet, and one of the beauties of our language is that virtually everybody speaks it, and there is an English language press in virtually every country in the world. So what I found very informative in trying to understand what's going on in Afghanistan is the Pakistani quality press, the Daily Jang, and so on, and they've got a much, much more sophisticated view of what's going on than we've got. We get this kind of topsy and tin story about what's going on. Our brave boys are out there doing their stuff, they get killed, explanation of who's fighting who about what, the way it's going, what the geopolitics are, what the Russians are thinking, what the Indian government's role is. This is all covered in great detail in the Pakistani English language press, but we don't hear any of it.
And even closer to home than that, if you pick up the Irish press, I don't mean the Irish press, I mean the Irish Independent, the Irish Times and whatever, they will cover what is happening in the European Parliament. They will cover in detail what European directives are about. Now, we don't over here. All we hear about is some sound, you know, some occasional sound bites, and we don't get the actual factual news, whereas in Ireland they do. And it's a difference in the political and media cultures.
So Steve's mentioned his favourite alternative news channels. Martin, what about a couple from you?
I think Russia Today is shaping up to be very interesting, because that's giving, you know, the opposition's point of view, if you like.
What about internet websites, for example?
Well, to be honest
with
you, there
are some digest sites on the
internet website I use most frequently is called whatreallyhappened.com, and it's actually run by quite a right wing libertarian American living in Hawaii, and his politics are not my politics, but it's a fantastic website because he's got 60 or 70 new posts a day on there, culled from the English language media of the whole world, and it's through that website, through that portal, that I've found all these other Asia Today is Asia Times is a really good magazine. Newspaper, and that's based in Singapore. But again, they cover all of the things that we don't get told. So, for example, if you remember when the SAS chaps were captured in Basra a few years ago, we were told that they were captured and then they were released by the prison where they were being held was stormed and all the rest of it. Now, what the Iraqi government said at the time, and it was reported by Xinhua, the Chinese news agency, and all the news agencies of the world, they reported that they were carrying a bomb. That's what the Iraqi government said. They gave a statement saying these guys were carrying a bomb. Now, everybody in Iraq knows that that's what the Iraqi government said. Everybody in the rest of the world knows that that's what the Iraqi government said. But the British people, we've not been told that the Iraqis said they were carrying a bomb.
Yeah, it's a little bit.
Because, of course, we don't do things like that.
We've been told that the Iraqi news sources said that.
Yes, exactly.
It's a bit
I mean,
weird,
I'm not
though.
Saying they were carrying a bomb. I'm just saying that was factual information, which we were just denied.
The weird thing about this is you've got whole sort of areas of the earth which are thinking one thing and having one impression of a particular event, and another area of the earth or a continent which has a different impression. Anyway, let's move on to one of our final stories, which is the anti-Tesco campaigners got some surprise support from the city council's leader. This is your chief, Barbara Jenk, Steve. So this is the campaigners who are opposed to the opening of a new Tesco store on Cheltenham Road, who have reacted with delight to a message of support from the leader of Bristol City Council. This is on Chris Brown's Bristol247.com. So why is Barbara supporting the anti-Tesco campaigners?
I think there is general concern about the proliferation of these small Tesco stores in Bristol.
Could there be an election in the offing, do you think? This is why?
Well, there could be. I don't think she's in this year's cadre of elections, so I don't think there's that. But, no, I mean, there is a problem about squeezing out of local shops, and I think that's the issue. And you've now got part in the centre of Bristol, you've now seem to have a Tesco Metro on every corner, and I think there is a worry about what the long-term effects will be on trade in Bristol.
It's all very well supporting them, but what can Barbara actually do, and what can the city's Liberal cabinet do?
Well, I think there is the rub, effectively, because the difficulty is the premises, I understand, has previous use as a retail shop. I think it was Bilo or something in the 1970s. And if Tesco's actually buy it up and can get planning permission, what we really need is a change in the planning laws so that you can't change the use. I mean, I was involved with the issue of the Friendship Inn down in Knowle a while back with the Bristol Pubs Group, and the difficulty there was that they could actually change the use from a pub to a supermarket without even applying for planning permission. And I think, you know, if you change use like that, then you should at least have to go and justify it before a planning committee.
Yeah, well, we've discussed planning issues on this programme quite frequently, and I think the law, in fact, is you know, we're a capitalist country, and basically developers do get to do what they want unless there is a good planning reason why they can't. So we've been talking about the biofuel plant at Avonmouth, which there's a lot of opposition to, but basically there's no power of Bristol City Council to stop something like that if it's got a legitimate business, and perhaps planning laws perhaps should be tight. We can say we don't want this if we don't want it.
I'm pleased that despite commercial pressure, actually, Bristol City Council did turn that down. We'll now see what happens if it goes to appeal.
Well, that's the problem, because they can always appeal, can't they?
An unelected inspector can overturn it.
So, Steve, are these sort of decisions being decided at planning committee, or are they being decided in the courts?
Well, it's a combination of both. I mean,
And what's the point of a planning committee making a decision when it just simply the courts come along and overturn it? I mean, that's anti-democratic, surely.
It's not a court. It's an important. It comes back to my earlier point about centralisation. It's an inspector appointed by the Secretary of State. I think it's ludicrous that you've got a situation where you can appeal against a refusal. You can't appeal against an acceptance. It's very much a one-way rule. In Ireland, you can. The planning system, as Martin's outlined, is weighted in favour of development, and it has been for 30 years, and we need to recognise that, and that's often an unpalatable fact, and I'm often explaining this to residents and saying, well, don't shoot the messenger, but I'm afraid that is the way the system is, and that probably needs some reform as well.
Well, we're coming up now to the time for the Sky News at 6, thanks to this week's guest, ex-leader of the Lib Dem group on Bristol City Council, and now councillor for Eastfield, Steve Comer. Next week at 5, Greens and Conservatives will be here to help us review
you
the week's news.
You are listening to BCFM.
Join us after the news.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol. It is run by volunteers and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.